Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Welcome to The Book Pod with Corey Perkin, the fortnightly podcast that brings readers and writers together. Today we acknowledge the traditional owners of the Boona Wurrung Nation where this podcast is produced and pay our respects to their elders past, present and emerging.
Welcome to The Book Pod. I'm Corey Perkin and thank you for joining us today. This week we return to the world of fiction with Loveland, a compelling new novel by Melbourne writer Robert Lukens. Loveland is set in contemporary Australia and Nebraska in the United States, but also travels back in time to a post-World War II America of men damaged by their war experiences, naive and young brides, small-town secrets, and abuse in marriage. It is the story of strong women and controlling, angry men, and I am beyond thrilled to be joined by Loveland's creator, Robert Lukens. Robert, it's so lovely to meet you.
Oh, it's so nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm a real fan of this book. I did not expect to. I have to confess I am not domestic noir, and let's just give it that genre name, because your book is way more intricate and complex than that. But that's how it was presented to me, as you've been pigeonholed with this particular book
by the publishers. And that's fine, you know, and it's such a difficult job. These publishers, reps, all these kind of people, they can't sit down and give someone a half-hour treatise on these things.
I
noticed when I signed my contract, I looked into the weeds of the contract, and there's a point where they just legally have to define what it is, and it was described as a literary whodunit. And I thought, all right, okay, that's what I wrote. That's fine.
Well, as a bookseller of 12 years, which I was until last year, but in my bookselling days, the publishing reps, of course, come to you and they are flogging their wares.
Yeah.
And so they give you the elevator pitch on the books that are the highlights on their list and the ones they think will suit your audience. But they will do these, you know, domestic noir or there's just bodice burners. All these kind of genres that are hilarious. But I do think, for me, Loveland, when I read the back of the book, I thought, okay, this is interesting. This is a story about abuse in marriage. Not sure, is it me? It sounded like a bit of a thriller, but I was drawn, I hate to be so shallow as this, but I was really drawn by the cover and also the fact that you've been published. This is your second novel and the first one did sell in my bookshop, although I didn't read it, but it was an honour to have The Everlasting Sunday 4 years ago in our shop and it sold. But also, as I said, in the hands of Allen and Unwin, they're such great, it's such a great publishing house for backing strong Australian talent, which is on the ascent. I imagine you've had a kind of an interesting journey with them, because your first book was not published by Allen and Unwin.
No. My first novel was published through University of Queensland Press, who I adore to this day, and they're an amazing publishing house. I think it was something to do with the way I'm always quite happy to talk about this. It's a bit of a taboo in the publishing industry. People don't talk, it's like sort of changing football teams. It's sort of, are you supposed to feel bad about changing teams and how did it happen? And people assume that, oh, maybe something went wrong or you're unhappy, but it's absolutely not like that. I suppose I'm fairly interested in following my instincts with these things. And with my first novel, I had no sort of ins in the publishing industry. I'd never published a word of fiction. I didn't have any contacts. I didn't have an agent, didn't have anything. So I finally, having spent about 25 years writing novels with abjectly not sending them out to be published, not one of them left my room. And I finally decided to send this one out. And I very naively, like childlike way, printed it out, put it in a yellow envelope and just posted it to University of Queensland Press. I think years
ago. Why did you choose them? As a Melbourne writer, why did you think, oh, well,
yeah,
we'll go north?
I'm originally from Brisbane. Okay. I grew up on the Sunshine Coast.
I thought and they must have been because you're one of your characters, and we'll get to the book in a minute, but one of your characters in Loveland, it starts in Brisbane. So, yeah, we'll talk about that in a minute. But
yeah, and then they – I think somewhere very – like in the 1990s, I think. I've got a piece of paper that I wrote in 1996, which I very grandly wrote. It was sort of my plan, my literary plan for the future. And one of them was to sign with Curtis Brown, because it was the only agent I'd ever heard of. And I'd read an interview with Nick Earls, who in Brisbane at the time, and this was the 90s, I think in Brisbane I just really attached myself to anyone who got out of Brisbane, bands who, like the Go-Betweens, that got out of Brisbane. And Nick Earls was this... It's hard to place him outside of Brisbane. I don't know how well known he is down here, but in Brisbane at the time, he was the guy that got out of Brisbane. This was Nick Earls. There were ad campaigns for Brisbane, like tourism campaigns headed by Nick Earls. The fact that there was a literary figure sort of that was well known on the streets, and he was signed with the University of Queensland Press initially. And so I just thought in my naive way, okay, well, that must be a reasonable place to be published. And so when my book was finished, I posted it to University of Queensland Press. They're the only people I posted it to. And I posted it to Curtis Brown, literally in a yellow envelope addressed. I didn't look on their website and check any – they weren't taking submissions. I just sent it in. And then I didn't hear anything for 18 months. I didn't get a receipt that they got it. I didn't get anything. And I just carried on in my way. And then in the same week, I got a phone call from University of Queensland Press. First contact with them was an offer to publish it. And 2 days later, I got a call from Grace Heifetz, my now agent, offering to represent me.
Ah, you see, that's how it works.
and it all just very strangely and just knitted together. And I had an incredible experience with University of Queensland Press with that book coming out. But as I said, I'd never sent it out to anyone. I was just this sort of, I think in a way, I was kind of shielding myself from the publishing industry. I've got a very long and I think for a long time, a not very healthy relationship with the publishing industry. I think my way of keep on going was I had this really big chip on my shoulder about I'm just going to write in my room. This isn't for publication. I'm not focused on that. I'm trying to sort of, you know, wearing the hair shirt and whipping my back. This has to be difficult. This has to be awful. This has to be the artist's journey. All these silly kind of childish ideas you have about writing.
Well, I'm glad you came out of the bedroom and stopped whipping yourself, because I wouldn't say for a second that this is a commercial, that's sort of degrading commercial novels, I suppose, but it's subtle and there's a very strong literary quality to this book. It's not a difficult read by any means, but its characters have complicated, interesting backstories, and it's not a quick kind of what I'd say an airport read, you know.
No.
But having said that, if I was travelling to London, this book would keep me, it's a page turner and it would keep me engaged. So I'm glad you made the move to Allen and Unwin, because they, nothing against University of Queensland Press, I love them too, but Allen and Unwin, as I said earlier, really do back young emerging talent, middle career authors, and they have a vast reach. And so it arrived in bookshops in March, I think, from memory.
That's right.
And as I said, it was not one that I would have necessarily picked up, but I was so deeply intrigued. The cover drew me in. I read the back. I thought, this sounds amazing. I know Robert Lucan's name, and then I was in. So I wondered if you can give us kind of the bookseller elevator pitch, which I'm so used to doing, because, of course, that's what people say when they come into a bookshop. What's this about? So you've got to get it in about a minute. But how do you explain the journey of May and Casey?
Yeah, I suppose the very brief elevator pitch that I tend to give when my publisher will hate me that I haven't got this all down rote, but essentially it's the story of May, who travels from Australia to a small town, Loveland in Nebraska, ostensibly to settle an inheritance, but in the process to escape her marriage, and while there discovers she has a shared dark history with her grandmother, Casey.
It's not obvious or apparent initially to May, of course. So May is, I would suggest, working class family, contemporary Brisbane. And as you say, that she's in a pretty difficult relationship with her husband, with whom she's been connected for many years, even going back to when they were teenagers. They have a son who's also showing patterns of behaviour that she feels are very like her husband. So that is also quite alarming to her too, that tension with her son who she adores. I found very, very interesting indeed. But her grandmother, who was an American, May's never really been aware of Casey, her grandmother's story, which I found so interesting that in families, so often people don't share. In my own family, I think we all tend to overshare probably too much. But some families do keep secrets. And the fact that Casey had come from America and May had never really inquired of this quiet, mouse-like woman in the kitchen. And it wasn't really until she dies that May discovers who Casey was.
Yeah, I think I'm always fascinated by that kind of separation that can be between people, even people that – and maybe this is the fact that I'm – even in my previous novel, Everlasting Sunday, this is, I suppose, a bit of an overriding theme, and people found this kind of – this veil between people, these barriers between people, this idea that you just want to, sometimes you just want to throttle them and say, can't you two just sit down and just talk for once? Can't you just actually speak to each other? And I think that's something I'm slightly preoccupied in my writing. I'm fascinated by the way I suppose it's my experience of living, that we know the version of each other that the other person chooses to share. You know, I have people that I've shared the same 10 square metres of carpet with at work for the last 12 years, and I don't know anything about their lives. I don't know anything about their sort of internal character. And I'm fascinated by that. I'm fascinated by that in terms of family as well. And the kind of things, the kind of material things and external things that can create that barrier. The characters in this story, so May, her mother Rose and Casey, they are tired. These are people that are coping. They've spent their whole life having to cope. And in some ways, they, because of their material position and the things they've been through in their life, it's almost as if they've just always put themselves last, because they can't just wake up in the morning and think, how can I express myself today? How can I more closely live with my family? They wake up every day and they get through the day. And so their personalities and their sort of true selves aren't able to sort of float to the surface. I often think of the characters in this story, they're almost submerged in water and they occasionally are able to get to the surface and take a gulp of air. But these women in this family who you sense that there's this need for them to connect, but there's always this barrier. And to be honest, a lot of the time through this is they are tired and they are busy and they are just trying to get through their days and through their weeks. And it almost seems like that kind of familial connection is a luxury they can't afford.
And you present them like that, but also there is an anxiety. So each of them, and I'd like to talk about this inherited, whether you can have inherited victim of abuse and patterns of behaviour that men of a particular kind are going to take advantage of, and whether they see the gaps there. Mm. But these women, I felt, were anxious every day, as you say, they wake up, but they're anxious as well as drowning. Mm. And particularly with Casey, when we go back to her experience in the 50s after she's married her former soldier in Nebraska, you did really feel that every day that she woke up. Mm. She was nervous. Mm. She was walking on eggshells.
Yeah.
And then, of course, it all unfolds as to why, and she realises that she's married a man that she didn't. But what is it about these patterns of behaviour? Were you trying to really focus on that this can be an hereditary thing with women, or is it just the sort of the luck of the draw for these three women?
Yeah, I think it's interesting, isn't it? I think I'm interested in the parts of our inheritance that are subconscious, the parts that are taught to us through behaviour as opposed to taught to us through direct contact, and these ways of coping, again, this idea of coping. And I think maybe some people, if you're very lucky in life, you don't feel that ever-present kind of pressure to cope through the day. Days are things to be explored rather than things to be got through. And I think I'm interested. I don't propose an answer to this question. I think sometimes there's the idea to, especially with the male characters in this novel, that idea of just inheriting patterns of behaviour just seems too neat to me. It seems too cute and it seems like too much of a let-off. And I think I am fascinated by, and I suppose it's the human condition that's kind of unanswerable, is the how much of it is
nature,
is our
nurture,
will and nature nurture stuff. And I'm fascinated by that. And I think sometimes it's too much of a let-off. It's too easy to say it's these things are just directly passed on from one to the other through some kind of magical inheritance or even just through behaviour? And I think obviously the answer is something much more complicated in between those. But I suppose particularly in relation to these male characters, like this is not a story of a simple, neat solution that they inherited these qualities from the previous generation, because that just seems... It's too neat for me, and it's too cute, and I don't think it's as simple as that.
Well, and then there's Rose, who is Casey's daughter, and May's mother, who can see an opportunity to break the pattern. So for our listeners, and this is giving nothing away, of course, but Casey has died in Brisbane, and she has left to the family what you call a boathouse, which. In Australian terms and in Melbourne terms, I guess we think of those little bathing boxes around Port Phillip Bay. But of course, it's much more than that. And you can tell us about a boathouse in a second. But there is the situation where Rose looks at her daughter's life and says, "You need to take this opportunity. This is your way out. This inheritance is the thing that can break the cycle."
Yeah.
And May is not really sure what all that means until she arrives in Nebraska, and then she has the strength to see this as some sort of escape. But tell us about the boathouse.
Yeah, so the boathouse is simply a small ramshackle wooden structure on the edge of the lake in Nebraska that we learn through the story is essentially just a utilitarian little building that was once a part of this much, much grander Loveland, this kind of weekend retreat for the rich. And
a big, beautiful guest house back in the day.
Yeah. And there was once a great promenade and a Ferris wheel, and on Sunday nights there would be fireworks displays, and the rich would come and dangle their feet in the cool waters of Nebraska during the spring and the summer. And these are places that really existed all across America, and often they were in the sort of – so obviously Nebraska is almost the center. It's a real flyover state. And the rich would – weekend at these places, and in America now they're dotted all across the landscape, the husks of these old grand places that were sort of booming right before the Great Depression. And obviously the Depression came in, these places fell into disrepair, and you can still find them now, these old rusted Ferris wheels all dotted around
America.
Gosh,
how melancholy.
Yeah, they're amazing. And I was fascinated by those, and I was fascinated by finding these places in Nebraska, because I've been fixated on Nebraska since I was a child. So when...
Okay, why?
I remember being about... It's a specific moment. Most of my life is sort of strange, ethereal moments I can't pin down. But this one I remember specifically. I was probably about 8 or 9, and I was going through my family's record collection, which I wanted to do, and there was like Eurogliders and Pseudo Echo and all the rest of it. And somebody in my family had a copy of Bruce Springsteen's Nebraska album. And I don't know if you're familiar with that front cover, but it's this incredibly striking photograph. It's a black and white photograph taken from the inside of a beat up old American pickup truck, looking out at this snow capped, distant, black and white, perfectly flat horizon, this impossibly distant horizon. And at the time I was this board short wearing, zinc creamed up Sunshine Coast kid who knew nothing of the world, and so this may as well have been Mars to me. This was the most fascinating image, and I remember almost like a cliche, I sat there cross-legged on the floor staring into this vinyl cover, imagining what was this place, Nebraska. And I was a kid who tend, and I suppose I'm an adult now too, tends to get very fixated on things, and this became a point of sort of eternal return to me, this image of Nebraska. And as the years went on, I would learn about the real Nebraska. I would read encyclopedias that my parents had, and I would borrow books, and I would watch films, and I would read histories in Nebraska. But as much as that, it was a place that I just developed this personal mythology to, this childlike place. It was this blank place on the map.
I'm assuming you went to Nebraska at some point.
I'm going to Nebraska for the very first time in 5 days.
My goodness.
And
me.
It was very much a part of the it was a huge decision to me, and an important decision to not go to Nebraska prior to the writing of this novel. I vacillated on it for several years. So this book's existed in different forms for about 7 years.
So I'm assuming Google has been a huge help here.
The residents of small Nebraskan lakeside towns have been a great help in this.
Really?
I've got – it's
you have,
it's
you have friends in little places. I do now.
I've got videos sent to me by the mayor of Carter Lake, who drove around town in his car with his camera out the window, narrating the entire town to me. I've got reams of documents from the president and sole member of the Carter Lake Historical Society, who sent me everything about this. I've been in touch with academics from the University of Nebraska. I've been in touch with everyone there, and it was this, but I. I just felt this block about going there, and it's something to do with my complicated relationship with this place, Nebraska, because this is a place that I know so well, so intimately, but it's a place of my imagination. It's the place of a 10-year-old child imagining what this place could be, because it also became a great refuge for me. It was always going to be the place if everything in my life went irredeemably wrong, if everything broke to a point that it couldn't be repaired, I could go to Nebraska. Nebraska was a place I could go to, and it was a blank space on the map.
Well, it's like Paul Simon's Graceland, isn't it?
Yeah. And I could disappear into the horizon. Yeah. And so it needed to, in some ways, exist in this mythological sense to me. And again, it's a place I know so well. And to me, I love existing in that state of sort of half knowledge. That it's a place I know the true details of so well, and the dreamlike state as well. And it's a place full of myth and dreams and ghost stories. I'm really fixated. I've got basically every roadside guide to Nebraska you can get. So these are just travel guides, and they say, like, go down Highway 75 and turn right at the well, and then you'll find, you know, the world's largest playable guitar, or the big longest cotton reel.
So this lake Loveland is the setting for your novel.
Mm.
And this lake, as you say, it had its heyday has long gone. Mm. And not only has the guest house and the Ferris wheel and everything gone to rack and ruin, but the lake itself, which I felt gave us an interesting provocation regarding climate change and the ecology and the systems, but the water is totally ruined and nobody's using the lake anymore. Did you have an actual lake in Nebraska upon which you based your lake?
I did. I think I suppose Carter Lake was an initial source route, but these are dotted all across anywhere slightly east or west of the Missouri or the Mississippi. There are dotted these because this is a stream of water that it's always evolving, change of direction. So ever since the intensive logging started in the 18th century, you would just get these log jams. And so you would get, literally, they were just flowing the entire forest down this lake all the way down to the coast. And they would hit a blockage and they would build up. And if there was a bit more of a flow, one day you would just wake up and the river had completely diverted around a canyon. So something that was in the state of Nebraska woke up in the state of Iowa, because this is a river that was constantly changing through human involvement. And so you do get these pockets and so many of these little what were once beautiful freshwater lakes that were constantly sort of, whenever there was a big rainfall, they would get renewed by the river. But they've now been cut off. And so I suppose something like Carter Lake, but there are dozens of these lakes all across Nebraska that just, as I said, I like to sit in that sort of state of half knowledge. I like not quite having a full visual image of these places. I like them existing in this kind of fugue area. But I suppose the Loveland Lake that we have here is something that I have this sense that over time it has just reduced and reduced and reduced. And in that same way that when you boil down a sauce for dinner, it intensifies and it intensifies. And so you end up with this lake that's almost pulling the landscape around it. I always have this image that the lake in this town is almost like a plug hole, and everything literally and metaphorically is kind of circling down into this lake. And even though it's decrepit and full of algae and stinks and is toxic, it draws everyone to it. The town still, for some reason, revolves around this lake, and I suppose my story, in a way, just keeps coming back to this lake.
Well, May is, at first glance, she is somewhat appalled, I guess, by the state of the lake, but also the boathouse from the outside. When she enters the door, it is incredibly well kept, and she is utterly shocked. Who is the person who's looking after this? So a lovely friendship emerges there. But she does have a sense of wanting to restore the lake and contribute to the community.
Mm.
And as we read through, we are left wondering, is this her future? Mm. So I'll just leave it there and readers can find out for themselves. But how did you, when you were creating May's first impressions of this area, what were you hoping to convey in terms of a link with her grandmother, the great unknown? Very much you get the sense that she just wants to get the deal done, get the place looking good and hand it over to the realtors to sell. But is that where the writing was taking you, or did you have in your mind the whole time that she was going to form this connection with the place and with her grandmother.
Yeah, I think that definitely evolved through the writing. So I think I'm driven entirely by my sort of instincts and the subconscious in my writing.
I had a feeling that was evolving as you were writing, actually.
And I think it was, as again, these things, I think because when you write from the subconscious, your mind, I know for me, it can reach for unusual, unexpected places, but also it can just reach for very familiar things. So there are some very archetypal things here. It's a small house on the side of a lake. It's a small town. These things that we've seen before. And I think initially my instinct was driving me to a neater solution. It's much neater if she went to this place and found this newfound sense of freedom and was able to slowly, carefully open up and discover herself and the lake to act as this kind of metaphor for that as she cleaned the place. But obviously these things are much more complicated than that and we don't get off that easily. And so I think part of the story of May, and we see a lot of this story from her point of view, she's scared on some level of allowing herself to be fully open to thinking about her situation. It would terrify her to think she's suddenly in this new place and she's free from her husband, even if it's just for a few days and she's in this other side of the world. She can never really allow herself you almost get the sense that if she fully stopped one day and thought about her situation and what was happening, it would be intolerable. She wouldn't be able to cope with it. So she kind of deceives herself and she lives in this slightly sort of veiled, fog-like existence because that's just how she gets through it. She can't think about it. If I stop and think about this, I'll collapse. I just have to keep going.
You're listening to The Book Pod, an audio community that brings writers and readers together.
A lot of this story is her arriving in Loveland and just through her circumstance there and through meeting Jean, who has this amazing sort of, who's a woman who lived in Loveland at the time of her grandmother Casey and we learn, doesn't give away too much because it happens quite early on, she's become the custodian of this old house. She feels this kind of sense of obligation to it. And Jean is this great catalyst for May. Jean is someone who we feel like she's unburdened. She is full of opinion. She's full of life. She drinks red wine. She swears. She sings along to the radio. She's this catalytic sort of presence for May. And so part of the story, I suppose, is about May sort of floating to the surface of her consciousness and occasionally allowing herself to realize this is my life and this is where I am and I do have some agency, but it's that kind of, she's coped all the way along by shielding herself from that and just kind of trying to float along without thinking about where she is.
The violence in the book is, I think, really beautifully handled because there is nothing more menacing than the really hidden, secretive, emotional abuse that, in this case, men can impact upon women. Sometimes, you know, a clock on the head is immediate and done, but this eating away that occurs in both marriages is really profound and interesting. And I know that some of the reviewers of Loveland have focused on you being a male writer, how terrifically well you've handled particularly those two female characters in Casey and May's story. So I need to ask you, because I think men and women can write across gender, we can do it all. You know, a good character is a good character regardless of who's written it. But you have really captured, I think, the fear that women can experience sometimes when there's a male that's trying to gaslight you or control you subversively and sometimes over a long period of time. You've really nailed that. How did you do that?
Oh, thank you very much. And that's obviously really gratifying to hear. And the first thing I'd say is this is absolutely not something I took lightly. I did not launch into this book saying, I can write about anyone I like. This is fun.
A hashtag Me Too moment. I'm going to make the most of it.
If you saw what I've been through, if anyone saw over the last 7 years of that I've been writing this book the way I – and so for the vast majority of the time of writing this book, it was never intended to be published. I write much more that isn't published than published. So since my first novel was published, this is the third or fourth novel I've written. In the same way that I think if you're a musician, you don't release every song you ever write into the world. It's just that obviously writing a novel takes a little longer sometimes. But this started as something very different. And originally it wasn't even a piece of fiction. So I first started writing this a couple of years before my first novel was published. So this is something I've lived with for a long time.
And was it set in Nebraska as well?
Originally it wasn't even a novel. Okay. It genuinely was. I I just had come to this conversation about male violence, male coercion, male control was something that obviously I thought about before, but it was something that was just, it was in us. It was coming, you know, these conversations we keep talking about and things were being discussed. And I wanted to really take that to heart. And I was just so fascinated, and I thought it was just my kind of duty, I suppose, to really interrogate this idea of male control and coercion, starting with myself. When I talk to my male friends about this, we all talk about how terrible it is and it's how awful, but it's always something happening somewhere else. It's some other men. It's somewhere this kind of imagined distant place. But it's not. It's us. It's I'm a man, my friends are men, we are men, and we live in this society where this is happening. It is us. So I just wanted to look at, is this a capacity that all men carry within themselves? Is this something that I carry within myself and I hide? I sort of, it's in my dark blind spot.
Well, so you make us consider this with the son whose name escapes me.
Francis.
Yeah, Francis, yeah. Is you.
Glad that, I could remember that.
Yeah. Who's 18, 19 years old?
Yeah,
something
17
like that.
Years, yeah.
And I sense that he senses that he could be becoming like his father, and he's rather fearful of that.
And this really wasn't initially just, and it was never intended to be published. I really just sat there almost doing a kind of complete forensic interrogation of myself and looking at myself and these kind of capabilities. And it was just, I guess, it's just a stream of consciousness kind of thought process. But then I'm a writer. This turned into a book. That's the way. I'm not a social worker. I'm not an epidemiologist. My brain works these things out through books. So it became a story. But initially, and again, this was never intended to be published because the world doesn't need to read this. It was a book focusing entirely on the male characters. I wanted to really look at what's the kernel of this. So I wrote all about their backstories, their family histories, the things they'd been through, their sort of internal psychology. And I'd keep getting to the end of this novel and being completely unsatisfied. I'd just hit a wall. And so I'd throw it away and I'd start again and again. And I did this maybe 5 or 6 completely rewritten from scratch.
So was it the female characters who showed you the way to this book?
I think it was in a way. I think initially it actually was more my relationship with these men. So having spent 6 novels with these men, and I found so many reasons and so many excuses but no justification for this. And having spent 6 novels with these men, I really started to consider my role as the author of this. Like in the universe of this novel, the one great power and privilege that I provide is someone's point of view. And so it was, having spent 6 novels with these men and just reached sort of the end of the road with them, it was a really conscious, punitive act from me to push them outside of this novel. So they exist in this novel through their actions and their culpability, but this became entirely the story of these women and how they navigate these almost immovable objects.
And have you come to the conclusion why these men, why men do this?
I mean, I'm not the person to answer that. And if I, well, no, and that's why I got to the end of this novel. And, you know, if I was the jury for these men, and I expelled them from the novel, because in a very real way, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter in terms of...
There are no excuses.
No, like I said, there's plenty of excuses and there's plenty of reasons, but they can't possibly stack up. And as I said, I'm a novelist. I'm not a social worker. I'm not a... I don't know if anyone could claim to know the answer to these questions, but it became within this universe of people that I came to know so well, like they became my life, these characters. And I was angry and I was hot-blooded, and it's like Game of Thrones or something. I expelled them beyond the Great Wall and I pushed these men out, and I don't feel sorry for it. And I'm not suggesting that that's how we should solve this in the real world. This was just a very specific instance of this. Is I felt that anger. I felt that I wanted to, that's what I could do in that moment. I had agency and where these other characters didn't. So I expelled these men out of the story.
But that's why we love novels.
Yeah,
that's why we love what you guys do. Because you provoke us and you make us maybe come up with the solutions. That's why so many thousands of people in Australia are in book clubs.
Yeah.
Because we try and then work out.
But I think too, it became very important to me that I wasn't trying to provide some solution to this. By damaging these men or expelling this man or whatever wrath we could put on these men, that didn't solve anything for these women. It didn't solve anything for these characters. It hurt them again. It was just their violence sort of final act. It was these, like, when violence hurts everyone in both directions, violence hurts everyone. Like, even we look at Casey in this, who we discover early on, found a way out of this relationship, but she's damaged through her whole life. She becomes this quiet, unknowable grandmother in the house who, you know, just even could never connect with her granddaughter because of the effects of these things that she carried through her. So it became very important to me. This wasn't some kind of, and it's interesting, I never even considered this word, but I've had people interview me and they keep mentioning this word about revenge, and people saying like, oh, so like kind of some people wonder if it's revenge.
I don't see it as revenge.
Not at all.
And it evolved.
Revenge implies a will or a sense of options, and these are women who had all their options taken away from them. So anyway, it was just very important to me that I didn't try and solve anything for these women or tie anything up with a neat bow. Not to say that I don't want it to be a satisfying novel, but I very much took my place and I think it is very much something to be considered that I am a man writing this novel. I don't think that should be sort of pushed off the table.
I don't think so either.
And also, I think the first place I start writing anything, writing from any characters, is I accept fully in my heart at the start that I will get everything wrong. That's my starting place for everything. And so from then on, it just becomes an experiment in empathy. And then you can write this novel. But then also the really important factor, I think it's something that's not considered enough, is it took a really long time for me to decide to want to try and publish this. Just because I wrote it doesn't mean I should. And it took a lot of convincing from my agent,
What was the catalyst?
It honestly was a discussion with my agent. So I'd written maybe three other novels before this that I just decided, which I loved and I thought were actually effective novels, but I get a strange thrill out of writing things and not publishing them. I think I just love it. I love writing things for their own sake. I think it's partly due to this history where I've written things for a long time just for their own sake. And I'm probably too attached to that process of sort of writing the equivalent of like writing a poem and throwing it in the ocean. It gives me a bit of a thrill to write a novel and walk away from it. But I wrote this one and it did feel different and did feel special. And I felt attached to it in a way I hadn't before. And so I very sort of meekly passed it over to my agent and I just said, let me have it. Pass it, like read this and let me have it if this book should not be out there and not be read.
And what did they say?
She was incredibly supportive. And then I just said, more than anything else I've ever written, this was read by more people before publication than anything. Because I just, you know, by definition, I'm not aware of my blind spots. I don't want to contribute to this conversation and just be an, you know.
Yeah, but you're not. But you see, this is what I was saying before about you've captured women so brilliantly. It's not just that you're trying to capitalize on this moment in time, which is, you know, we're now as a community terribly aware of secrets, what goes on behind doors, women being abused physically and emotionally, so on and so forth. There are scenes like, for example, at the very beginning, set in Brisbane, and May is trying to scratch together a living to support the family. Looking after little kids, and she's looking after a baby as a nanny. And now all of her frustrations with that baby in those first few pages and the frustration of, and you know, I've got to get home and I've got to cook the meal, I've got to, like, that is a woman talking, Robert.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, that is, you've got right into the, already you've, in a few pages, you've presented a woman who is on the verge, but we're not sure on the verge of what. And so what is her get out of jail card? What is it going to be? What's her moment of awakening? And I think that is just really brilliant.
Well, thank you. And that's obviously great to hear. I guess that's the great unknowable to me, is how effective I was in those kind of things. But like I said, I suppose I tried to simultaneously approach this like I would write anything else, from a place of, this is kind of like original sin of being a writer to me. It's like inherently art is incapable of capturing the totality of life. Like art necessarily fails. And I think that's a great starting point for any sort of empathetic exercise, is to say, I'm starting off and I don't know anything and I've got this all wrong.
And the rest is a bonus,
as opposed to starting off and thinking,
I want to get into the bottom drawer of Robert Lukens, or it sounds like it's actually an entire library probably of novels that haven't been written, which is so interesting because this is your second.
Yep.
And so seeing on the book that this is your second book, obviously then I say, okay, you're an emerging writer, but mm-hmm. clearly you're not because you've been doing this for a long time. When did you start writing and have you made the leap yet into full-time writing?
Answer the second part first. Absolutely not. But I would love it if that was – I think mainly it's – I don't know, I'm torn about that because obviously it's seen what would be amazing to be a full-time writer, and some things are happening in the background that, you know, maybe I'll get closer to that over the next couple of years. But there's an incredible freedom to not being tied to that. I know I have friends who are full-time writers, and there's an incredible veil of anxiety that goes over a writer when suddenly you have deadlines that really mean something. Deadlines mean your livelihood. And I think I have this incredible...
So what do you do?
I work at Melbourne University. I work in mental health research. I've been doing that for quite a long time. And I have a very, very wonderful boss who is very encouraging of my writing. And I'm very lucky that my job is very flexible and I can sort of manage around things. But every single word of this novel, every last word was written on the train to work. Same with my last novel. I just write on the train.
On a laptop? On a laptop.
So I deliberately catch a very, well, for, it's different now, obviously, because we're all locked down at home. But this novel was completed just, I suppose the initial draft that was accepted for publication was finished a week before lockdown started, before the pandemic came. So I would always catch the very early train. I'd catch a 5:50 train in the morning, and it was a 45-minute journey to work. And I'd get that early train because it wasn't busy. And I would sit in the same corner and I'd cross-legged, open the laptop, and I had 40 minutes to write. And that's how I wrote this entire novel and the one before and everything else, because I don't have any other time in my day. But there's something I've been writing for so I wrote my first novel when I was 14, and I've basically written novel every year ever since then. It was my great, it's just about 10 years into that, I stopped thinking about writing so long ago in terms of I don't wake up and think, oh, should I have a write today? It's just what I do, in the same way that, you know, I know people who are addicted to going to the gym or going for a run and they don't think about it. They wake up, and if they don't go to the gym, they start to feel itchy. They start to feel like, I feel like that with writing. If something happens and I can't write in a day, I get all frustrated and I get all uneasy and I have to go and write. And it's just, it's habit as much as anything else, but it's just so woven into the fabric of my life.
So are you suffering from imposter syndrome here, do you think?
No, only
good, because the books are great.
Well, thank you, but it's not even to do with that. I think the one positive, and I've analysed this so much. So I wrote between the age of 14 and 40, I wrote a novel every year that I never let anyone else read. And I worked so hard on those things. Everything else was to support that. And so what it did do, it developed a very unhealthy relationship to publishing, because there was places along the way where it was this strange.
But you weren't pitching the novel.
No, I was just.
So why were you angry with the publishing? And you could have.
No, but it was more this. It was a self-protection. You know, we all have to find ways to get through
this.
So
you're afraid of rejection.
I suppose so. Like that would be the obvious solution. But it was my way of, yeah, exactly, getting through it. I couldn't be rejected if they never even got to see it. It was this way. I just kept telling myself I'm going to learn my craft. I'm going to teach. But also I had this, I've never taken a writing class. I've never read a book about writing. I got real chip on my shoulder about it. And I think it obviously was self-protection, because this was the thing I loved more than anything. What if I couldn't do it?
Praise the Lord that you sent that manuscript to University of Queensland Press.
Yeah, and I think, to be honest, the only reason that happened, I think, it wasn't that I had some great breakthrough or just had a, but I was just tired. I really just started to think, genuinely, I don't know how long I can keep doing this for.
And how do you feel now?
It's interesting you said before about whether I am or I'm not an emerging writer. I absolutely am, because I'm just beginning this journey. I'm only just shedding all these kind of unhealthy approaches to writing, that writing has to be this grinding, painful, awful, all-consuming, terrible experience. I feel like all that weight has lifted from me. And it's because I don't have to hide from this kind of, because this is what I love more than anything. This is the way I exist in the world, is writing. And before, the idea that this thing that meant so much to me, if I couldn't do it, what if I stunk? How would I compute that sort of psychically? And now that I can get books published, it seems, I can just let all that go and actually exist with this. And I've had just the most incredible experience with this, because I now realize that whereas before I thought the writing experience was 100% the writing, now I realize that's that's 50% of it, because the other 50% are people reading it. And it's kind of this like breathing. It's like the inhalation is the
right. You see, we're taking your characters and we're now doing things with them.
Yeah.
Aren't we?
But I realize what an absolute honor, and I just cherish that experience so much. And it's why, and I think because the one good thing that came out of those 25 years of writing by myself is I have just a complete sort of mental separation between writing and publishing. They're two completely separate things, and I cherish both equally. But for instance, so I'm not afraid of a bad review. I'm not afraid. That's just what a joy that my biggest problem in my life is a newspaper might write a bad review of my book. Like, what an amazing opportunity to have. So I just, and it annoys all my friends who are writers, because I just have a lovely time all the time.
Well, that's a lovely segue, because I did want to read this before we close today. So BJ Silcox, who's a terrific reviewer with The Guardian Australia, in the March review of Loveland, this is what BJ wrote. In my mental bookshelf, Robert Lukin's debut novella, the 2018's The Everlasting Sunday, sits alongside volumes like Wallace Stegner's Crossing to Safety and Richard Yates' The Easter Parade, novels of lavish melancholy and human grace. Thomas Savage's The Power of the Dog is on that shelf, as is John Knowles' A Separate Piece and an obligatory copy of John Williams' Stoner. Quiet classics. I don't think there is a better review in Australia going around than that. Being an absolute, I adore Stoner. Yeah. It is in my top three, as is Wallace Stegner's Crossing to Safety. Our producer, Mindy, would be wholeheartedly agreeing with me there. So this is pretty fine praise for you. And I just wanted to just pick up on what you've said about full-time or part-time writing. Mm. I hope somebody from the Albanese government is listening to this interview, and I hope particularly Tony Burke, the arts minister. We talk so often about our nation's artists and creators punching above their weight. Mm. And I think in particular with writers, we are world class, whatever that term means. And your novel would sit comfortably in that top 10 section of Barnes & Noble in New York or Daunt's Bookshop or wherever it may be in London. And I just lament the obstacles. I worry about the obstacles that Australian publishers and their writers face all the time, mainly because we have a small reading population here.
Yeah.
But is there no way that we can find more funding for our writers? Is there no way that we can look at promoting them in bigger and more meaningful ways internationally? And Robert Lukin's, you are an example of what we need to do better and stronger. You need to get off that train and back into your study and pulling out all those manuscripts. So my next question was going to be, so what's your next novel? But it sounds like you've probably got about 25 of them in your drawer. Are you working on another one for publication?
I am.
Right, and good to hear.
Yeah, and I honestly feel like I'm at the start of this process. Even though I spent all those years writing by myself, I'm only truly starting to learn about my own writing now. I really am, and I feel more energized and optimistic now than I ever have. Because I'm just fully opening my mind and my heart to that. I've got so much to learn. I've got so many people to learn from, and it's just been incredible. Like, before my first novel was published, I'd never met another writer, and now I genuinely feel like they're my peers. I meet these people. I just came back from the Sydney Writers Festival, and I don't feel like a phony. And it's not because I think I'm so great. It's just because it's just such a welcoming, amazing community. Like, even there's all these incredible writers in Australia, and they very secretly help everyone. They very secretly go around. I think it is because everyone knows what the precarious condition of this and how hard it is. So we're all just a bunch of, honestly, from someone who's just released a book through a small publisher through to the big high flyers, we kind of all know each other and talk to each other and help each other.
It's the helping and the camaraderie and the willingness to share. Nobody is kind of driven by competition or ego. They're very willing to share. Before we finish, of course, I must ask you our usual question, which is, you know, we know that great writers are inspired by other great writers. If you were on that desert island and if you had to, as the ship was sinking, grab someone or something, some book or some collection of works, what would it be?
I've thought hard about this because I wanted to give you an absolutely honest answer. So I think it's the book that I probably feel the deepest personal connection to, and I feel such a connection to it that I can't even analyze whether it's the greatest book ever or the worst book ever. It's Evelyn Waugh's Brideheads Revisited, which is Evelyn Waugh was probably the first writer that I just read voraciously my entire life, but in my early 20s, I think I read Brideshead before I read any other Evelyn Waugh books, and it was the first book that I truly, truly went to that place of this is the deepest, most wonderful thing in my life, and that book meant so much to me. And then I just devoured Evelyn Waugh's books, and he's probably he's the only author that I collect his books. I have, I think, about 15 copies of Brideshead Revisited. And again, so I don't know if it's a great book. I suspect it is, but Brideshead Revisited is, it's just such a, I think Evelyn Waugh, because of the persona that he's created around himself and the kind of, I think people remember some of the scenes from the Brideshead BBC series, and I think a lot of people haven't actually read the book. And if you read the book, it's an incredibly sensitive book. Evelyn Waugh would love to project this idea to the world that he was this gruff country gent. Mm. But there's this moment, the moment, especially in the mid period of his books, Handful of Dust and even Put Out More Flags, around that kind of era, he finally exposes this very kind of broken, sensitive side to himself. And it's all mixed in with the humor and obviously just the incredible, writes like an angel, but he could do that in his sleep. But it's when he exposes the kind of fragile nature of himself and his characters that he gets something. So I suspect if he's an author that people have, you know, he's just one of those authors you hear about. And Brideshead, people think, oh, I know that. It's just kind of like posh people in a big house. And read that book. It's such a sensitive portrayal of love and pain.
And loss of religion.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, all of that. Robert, it's been great to meet you. I have to congratulate you again on Loveland by Robert Lukens, who's been our guest today. It's published by Allen and Unwin. And Poddies, if you are in a book club, may I suggest that you put Loveland on your list so that your group can tackle this? In some of the situations, even Robert himself doesn't know the answers necessarily. So we'll be looking forward to hearing what you make of it. Robert, thanks for joining us on the Book Pod.
Thanks so much for having me.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.